Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the life of the man who was the first African-American to serve a full term in the United States Senate. His name was Blanche Kelso Bruce. He was born a slave on a plantation in Virginia in 1841. He went on to become involved in Republican politics in the state of Mississippi, held some local office, made a lot of money in real estate, became the first black to serve a full Senate term, and went on to marry the daughter of a wealthy black Philadelphia doctor, and the two of them broke racial barriers as a socialite couple in Washington, D.C. of the 1880s. The story is told in a newly published book, The Senator and the Socialite. The subtitle is The True Story of America's First Black Dynasty. It's published by HarperCollins. And our guest this morning in this hour of the show is the author of the book, Lawrence Otis Graham. He's an attorney, commentator on race, politics, and class in America. He's the author of a number of books, including Member of the Club, which featured his undercover experience as a busboy at a discriminatory country club. His most recent, before this one, is a book titled Our Kind of People Inside America's Black Upper Class, which was a national bestseller. Also, his work has appeared in a number of other places, New York Times, Essence, U.S. News and World Report, and Best American Essays. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk with Lawrence Otis Graham, you certainly should feel free to call in with questions and comments. All you have to do, people who are listening, all you have to do to join the conversation is to pick up the telephone and dial the number. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL or 9455 for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, people can call in with questions. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can get in as many different folks as possible and to keep the program moving, but anyone's welcome to call. Mr. Graham, hello.
Hello, David. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. Why is it that for most people, this is a new story? They've never heard of this man?
I think one of the reasons why people have not heard of Senator Blanche Bruce is because the nation has done very little to commemorate those African Americans who served during Reconstruction. It's a period that many Southerners in particular are embarrassed by because of the terrible treatment that followed Reconstruction and that was aimed at the awful treatment that was aimed at African Americans. And it's one of the reasons why even when his portrait was unveiled, when Senator Bruce's portrait was unveiled at the U.S. Capitol 3 years ago, they invited family members to come, and only one descendant showed up. And it's the unfortunate thing about it is that even when I look at how our postage stamps or other ways that we commemorate African-American elected officials, they're just simply absent. In 159 years, the Postal Service has issued stamps. Never once have they put a black elected official on. Plenty of entertainers and athletes and as well as a few black civil rights leaders, but when it comes to actually elected officials, they've never put a black elected official on a postage stamp. So it's a period of history that people are embarrassed by because the quote-unquote redemption period that followed the 12 years of Reconstruction really ended up undermining black America. Those who had made success, found success as their jobs were taken away, they could no longer vote. There was the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. So along with that history, erased Senator Bruce's history in Mississippi and in Washington.
Mm-hmm. He was not the first black senator. There was one who came before.
Right.
Interestingly enough, this was a man who filled out the term of Jefferson Davis.
Ironically, yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah, so Hiram Revels, who was elected before Senator Bruce, was only there for almost a year. It was actually 11 and a half months, and quickly ushered out. And Blanche Bruce is the first black to serve a full term, the full 6-year term in the U.S. Senate. And Revels' term interestingly, like many of the terms held by most blacks during Reconstruction, they had very limited access to government, and even after they held their terms, they had no further roles in the United States government, which was very different for Senator Bruce, because even in addition to holding a six-year term, and as you mentioned in the introduction, he was also a very wealthy man, married a very wealthy woman, and he also served under four other presidents after that and held top jobs, a fabulous job as Register of the U.S. Treasury, which put his signature on all U.S. currency. So he had the unusual career for African Americans.
When he got to the Senate, there were some senators that befriended him and supported him, and yet I would imagine there were probably others that were not particularly happy to see a black man among them.
Right. In fact, his very first day at the Senate, the tradition had always been that the senior senator from the state, and in that case it was James Alcorn, his role was to walk Senator Bruce down the aisle to welcome him so that he could take the oath of office. But he refused to do that, held up a newspaper in front of his face and refused to get up because he simply did not want, as did most of the, certainly the Southern senators, did not want a black man there. And I guess not surprisingly, it was actually Northern senators who mentored him. For example, Senator George Hoar from Massachusetts, Senator Roscoe Conkling from New York, and in fact it was Senator Conkling who walked him down that day and also sponsored him to get on certain committees and mentored him to such an extent that Senator Bruce named his only son after Roscoe Conkling. He named his own son Roscoe Conkling Bruce.
James Alcorn, who was the senior senator from Mississippi, as you say, the man who by tradition should have escorted Senator Bruce down the aisle and tried to even almost to pretend that he wasn't there. Interestingly enough, it seemed that earlier in Bruce's career that Alcorn was supportive of him. And I guess that would suggest that perhaps people within American politics at the time or within the Republican Party or maybe it's just within the party in the South had perhaps mixed feelings about the participation of African Americans as if they wanted them and yet they were not comfortable with them perhaps participating fully and completely and rising to whatever level.
Rising to that level, yeah. Right, because it's an interesting story. I mean, having been born a slave in 1841, he was freed in 1863. He decides to go to Oberlin College, which is one of the few schools in the nation that would educate free blacks. So he went to Oberlin for 2 years, and he ran out of money, and then went back to Mississippi where he had been a slave for a short amount of time, and became the way he gained his wealth and why he gained those first mentors like Alcorn was that they saw this well-educated, articulate, now freed black man arrive in their state in Mississippi. He became local sheriff and then local tax collector and assessor, and he was being mentored all this time because the Republican Party at that time, which was the Liberal Party, the party of Abraham Lincoln, they were the ones that were supporting civil rights for blacks, and since Alcorn was a member of that party, he was encouraging Senator Bruce and was helping him get these positions, which also helped Senator Bruce become a relatively wealthy man because he was allowed to keep a percentage of the property that he assessed and that he collected taxes on, and then he purchased property and used rental properties and purchased even a former plantation. But what ended up happening is Senator Alcorn was happy to see him rise to those local-level positions, even state-level positions, but once he was offered the position of lieutenant governor and then turned it down and said, no, I'd rather be a senator, that's when Senator Alcorn turned against him.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps I should just very quickly reintroduce our guest, Lawrence Otis Graham. We're talking about his recently published book, The Senator and the Socialite, The True Story of America's First Black Dynasty. It's published by HarperCollins. It is the story of the life of Blanche Kelso Bruce, who was the first African-American to serve a full term in the United States Senate. He represented Mississippi in the Senate from 1875 until 1881. He was a man who was very successful in politics. He was very successful in business. And it's quite an interesting story. So you can take a look at the book, and questions are welcome, too, here on the show, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk a little bit about Josephine Wilson, who became Mrs. Bruce, the wife of Senator Blanche Bruce.
Exactly. She is the socialite, and the title, The Socialite. Josephine was from a, unlike Blanche Bruce, she came from a free black family. And as you can see from the photos in the book, she, and on the cover, she is a very light complexion woman that, and that could have, had she chosen, could have passed for white. She never did. She was actually always involved with black organizations, both civic and political and social organizations, charitable groups, as well as Howard University. But her family, her father was a very well-known, respected black dentist from Philadelphia and later Cleveland, who he himself had written a very provocative and controversial book. It was similar to my book, Our Kind of People, which talked about the black upper class. His book focused on the black elite in Philadelphia. And he and his wife, so he was African-American. His wife was also African-American. She was a school teacher. So Josephine, although was light complexion, she came from this free black family, and so from the city, and being in Philadelphia and being Cleveland, her family looked down on Senator Bruce from the very beginning. Even as he was courting her, they were excited that she was dating the senator. But then, when he proposed marriage, they got a little anxious and a little nervous. And I put some of the letters in the book that I was able to find, many of these letters between herself and her parents, between herself and Blanche while they were dating, while he was in Washington and she was in both Cleveland and Philadelphia, that her family panicked because they thought, wait a second, he was a slave. Are we going to have to invite his former master? Will we have to invite former slaves to the wedding? Because this was a very socially conscious family that cared about money, cared about family background, cared about education. And they were really not won over by him until he had literally taken a train to Saks, the precursor to Saks Fifth Avenue, at that time it was called Saks and Company, the department store, went to New York, and he spent $300 on honeymoon clothing. It wasn't until he had done that and that they saw that, they said, okay, fine, we can get on board with this. And they had an elaborate wedding that was actually the first black wedding ever to be covered in the society pages of the New York Times and Washington Post. And this is 1878, so this was a family that was well before their time.
Yeah. What I think one of the aspects of this story that's really fascinating, and it's something really interesting to talk about, is, and something we don't, I think, talk about very much, but something I know that you're interested in and has been part of your writing, is the ways in which, in this country, race and social class get tangled up, and and work in unusual ways, particularly the notions of class, that for the kind of people that you were talking about here, perhaps social class meant more than did the notion of race, or at least they tried to live as if social class meant more than the notion of race.
Absolutely, because there was a and the interesting thing, Dave, while I was researching this for 5.5 years, I just uncovered so many aspects of this upper class life, how it tied them to not just other upper class black families, but also to liberal white upper class families, because they were very close to President Grant. They were obviously close to Frederick Douglass, Booker T. Washington, and other upper class black families in Washington and elsewhere. Because in every city, there were well-to-do black families who had started banks, and this is starting like in the late 1860s, early 1870s, who had, since there were no white banks that would loan money to black families, there were no white-owned insurance companies that would insure black property, there were no white funeral homes that would even accept black bodies. So there were entrepreneurial black families in cities like Atlanta and Nashville and Washington and Chicago, places like this, that became wealthy families by starting these businesses. And this was a social circle that populated the world of Blanche and Josephine Bruce. And that's how they became this black power couple in Washington, by befriending other wealthy blacks. And their lives, even though they lived they were black people who obviously were not permitted in segregated white buildings and restaurants and areas like that, but at the same time, they lived in a world where they had the money to buy their way out of some discrimination. For example, and there are photos in the book, the Bruces bought two beautiful, beautiful townhouses in Washington, both of which are historic, national historic landmarks, one on DuPont Circle and one on M Street, both in northwest Washington, that are in beautiful neighborhoods now and neighborhoods that were obviously very beautiful then. And they primarily did this because Josephine, in particular, recognized that Reconstruction was ending. She knew that he could never go back to Mississippi and be reelected because of the rise of the Klan and the end of Reconstruction. So she said to him, we need to position ourselves as important Washingtonians and people that presidents will perceive you as a good advisor, since you'll never be elected again. You could serve as future future advisor to future presidents.
Mm-hmm. They, by all indications, if you judge by the photographs of these people, they were a very handsome couple. They're very striking. They certainly were wealthy.
Yes, they're right.
They had money. They had class. How were they received by white Washington society?
White Washington society initially found them to be a curiosity. They were written about tremendously, waiting for the wedding, waiting for her arrival in Washington, and even after that, because the major question was, how was Washington, which was a southern segregated city? It was not, this is not Chicago, it's not New York. At that time, it was a very, very southern segregated city. And the question was, who would welcome her with the other senators' wives, with the Supreme Court justices' wives, welcome her into their home? Because at that time, there were liberal Republicans who did socialize with them, liberal white Republicans who did socialize with them, more with them even than they would with Frederick Douglass, who also had an appointed job but was still perceived as a former slave, since although Senator Bruce was a former slave, he never wrote about it, never talked about it. And it's almost as though he appropriated his wife's freeborn status after marrying her, because people treated him, because he was educated, he was very sophisticated, dressed very well, and she as well. So, and the way they entertained was in such a way that they hired white caterers. They hired, you know, the types of people. They were not Baptists. They were not members of the Baptist faith. They were both, he was Congregational. She was Episcopal. That was the black upper class. Those were the black upper class faiths within the Christian church, which is, and that was same was true among the white community. So the white community first treated them as a curiosity. Then they, some liberal Republicans, white Republicans, did socialize with them and met with them and worked with them. What was interesting is how the black community dealt with them. That was quite different, because the black Mississippi community was concerned that he was too wealthy, had too great an access to affluent whites, and they thought, how is he going to represent us? The black upper-class community in Washington embraced them immediately. The black working-class community in Washington basically rejected them because they felt they lived too extravagantly. Their son, they decided to send to Phillips Exeter, the boarding school in New Hampshire, and then later sent him to Harvard. And, you know, he entered that world in 1896 at a time that very few whites had access to Exeter and Harvard, let alone blacks. So they were very suspicious of the Bruce family. Hmm.
He, as we mentioned, Blanche Bruce was born a slave. His mother was a slave. His father was the slave master.
Right. His father was the owner.
His
was father
his
owner,
was
the
was
only
his
reason
owner.
Why he was freed in 1863.
And Josephine Wilson, her father's father was white.
Her father's father was white. Exactly.
Well, was that something that was either discussed or thought about, or was that?
It was well known within their family and among their close friends. When I look at the letters, that it was very well known, very well acknowledged, and it existed in so many of the black upper class families. It's not an accident that the black upper class at that time, and still to some extent today, is a more light complexion group, and that is because their white ancestry is much closer than others, and that was the reason why they were able to go away to college while they had some of that initial wealth. And then what they ended up doing was married each other and then used color as a status symbol. There was used to be this old term, even while I was growing up in certain organizations like Jack and Jill and my mother, when my mother was in the Lynx, the old brown paper bag and ruler test, mm-hmm. where was if you have to be, in, to be accepted into the black upper class, you have to be lighter than that brown paper bag and your hair as straight as a ruler. And this was a community that continued and even that populated Howard University and Spelman College and Morehouse College and certain sororities and fraternities like the Sigma Pi Phi Boulé, which their son belonged to, that Roscoe belonged to while he was superintendent of schools in Washington, an organization that still, mostly all these organizations still exist today, that most of the black upper class and that people aren't comfortable about it, talking about it. I mean, when I wrote about it in Our Kind of People, people were very upset. They said, you're not supposed to be telling these stories, and not so much because they don't want white people to know, but because they don't even want the working class or middle class blacks to know. I mean, when I went away to Harvard in school, to Harvard, I knew many students there who were in Jack and Jill with me, who had grown up with me. We had the directory, you know, that told you who was coming from Chicago, who was coming from Beverly Hills, who was coming from San Francisco and from St. Louis, and that these same issues were being dealt with the Bruces because they lived awkwardly between a black world and a white world, where the black world kept saying, you have too much success, too much money, too much fame to be fully, to be what they considered authentically black. But then the white community was saying, we don't care how much money you have, you're still black. Your color is different. Your racial background is different. So they still left trapped. They were left trapped between two worlds.
Yeah. Did in his public life, as a senator, in the other posts that he held, did he feel some particular responsibility to try to do whatever he could to make things better for African Americans?
Yes, he did. He was very cautious during his first 2.5 years in the Senate, but after that, he really did start to hit his stride and to advance legislation. I mean, it wasn't just legislation on behalf of African Americans, also Chinese immigration limits, policies that helped Chinese immigrants, helping blacks who were trying to change the racial policies at West Point, also getting monies that had been lost through the collapse of the Freedmen's Savings Bank. So many blacks around the country had invested all their money in these banks, and the banks had collapsed, and the government did nothing. He was responsible for getting a lot of their monies back. He was also responsible for getting money to blacks who were escaping the Deep South after all of not just political corruption, but all of the white hate groups like the Ku Klux Klan through lynching and burning through of homes. He was able to get some money to help those who had escaped to Kansas. And then again, when he was Register of the U.S. Treasury, he had also did a lot, not in the beginning, but after the first couple of years, because he was always very cautious and very fearful that these positions could be snatched away from him, and they could. Because he was the rare and one and only black often there, but he always had blacks working in his office, always had and always made sure that got blacks jobs in other places. Where he was not supportive was when it came to his close family members. He had 6 brothers. He was only supportive of one of them because that was the only educated one, Henry, who ultimately ran for Kansas State Legislature. But he was not supportive of his less educated family members, because I think that he was honestly embarrassed by them, because he himself was barely welcomed into his wife's elite family.
We have a caller here to talk with, and we certainly would welcome others. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or if you'd be happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Our guest is Lawrence Otis Graham. If you'd like to read the book, it's The Senator and the Socialite, and it's published by HarperCollins. Here we have a caller on our line number 1 to talk with right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I simply wanted to point out that there were other politicians, including one of our presidents, who had black ancestors. Warren Harding's grandmother was black.
That's right.
A less illustrious example, but nevertheless, I think an important example.
Right. You're making the caller is making a very important point. I mean, obviously, we've heard the story of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, and he's, as many people have pointed out, about Warren Harding's grandmother. There was a lot of racial mixing. I mean, no one was at that time, certainly not at that time, and barely at this time today, are people willing to acknowledge that that this racial mixing went on and still goes on, because in fact there were family members in the Bruce family, that Senator Bruce's son Roscoe, when he went off to Exeter, his very closest friend and very old family friend was John Syfax, and the Syfax family owned quite a bit of the acreage that Arlington National Cemetery was built upon, and they became a wealthy family when the government bought much of this acreage. John Syfax at Phillips Exeter was there as a black student, and with Roscoe Bruce, his roommate, and when he got to Trinity College in Connecticut, he registered as a black student. But when he got to Columbia University Law School in New York, he realized that New York law firms did not hire blacks at that time, so he changed his registration to Caucasian and shaved his head because he was light complexion enough, and passed for white for the next 45 years, married a white woman, never told her. He joined a Wall Street law firm where he became a partner, and even lived in a restricted all-white Upper East Side Manhattan apartment building, never told them. And it actually was not until his grandfather, and I'm sure some of the listeners have already read this story because it was excerpted from my book in last issue of Reader's Digest, but he lived his life for 45 years, and it wasn't until he discovered that his black grandfather, John McKee, had died, leaving a $2 million estate in 1945, and said it's left for the last surviving grandchild, but the kicker in the will said he has to publicly acknowledge that he's black. And so that was what required John Syfax to publicly acknowledge, and that's how his wife found out that he was black. And what did she do? She immediately filed for divorce. His law firm fired him. His apartment building made him move out. And so it was his decision to go for this money and that it forced him to publicly acknowledge that he was black, but yet still was rejected. And the unfortunate irony of this is right after he proved to the courts that he was the grandchild and they were about to reward the $2 million, he had a fatal heart attack at Lenox Hill Hospital in Manhattan and died. But this was a story that went on in so many families that people passing, and some family members went along with it because they said they were their family members, their siblings or their children were doing it for economic reasons, or they were doing it to get into schools that did not allow blacks. So it's something that still goes on today. And I've, since the book came out 3 weeks ago, I've even gotten calls and emails from family members of Senator Bruce, who I always wondered why they were not at that unveiling of his portrait, and they're now telling me the reason why is because they live as whites and they don't want sometimes in a couple of the cases their spouses to know that they're black, and they're not that distantly removed. They just are light complexion. I said, well, how do you explain your coloring? Because I know what your parents look like because I know what his grandchildren look like. And they said, well, we tell our spouses or our friends that we're of a different ethnic group. And some have told me that one said that she says that she's Cuban. I mean, others say that there are other things, but they'd rather be anything but African-American.
It comes to mind that at the time Senator Bruce was in office, there must have been, Thaddeus Stevens must still have been a senator, and his wife was black.
Oh, that's an interesting point. That's a very interesting point. I didn't, in my research, obviously I was obviously not focusing on sort of like the private lives of other senators, but that's a very interesting point. I mean, I was very fortunate to be able to get access to Senator Bruce's private letters and his Josephine's and their sons and their grandchildren, because I follow three generations of the Bruce family. And on occasion, they definitely do refer to other people who are either passing or who are married outside of the race. So it's definitely an issue where race and class are constantly crossing back and forth with these families. And they're always around prominent people, prominent blacks and prominent whites, because the family eventually ended up working for the Rockefellers in New York, working very closely with them. So race and class remained a big issue throughout this family's existence.
Well, thank you. Most interesting program.
Well, thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We mentioned at the beginning of the program, you told the story of how on the day that Blanche Bruce was to be sworn in to the Senate, the tradition was that the senior senator was supposed to walk him down the aisle up to the front where he would take the oath, and that the senior senator from Mississippi, James Alcorn, just sat there reading a newspaper, almost pretending as if Blanche Bruce wasn't there. And another senator from another state, this was Roscoe Conkling.
Right, from New York.
He said, sir, let me. And he did it.
Right.
And so that would, you know, that gets to me asking about, well, you know, given the fact that, yes, it's true, the Republicans in the South were interested in getting African Americans in politics to a certain level. And how was it that Blanche Bruce actually managed to get elected to the United States Senate?
Well, at that time, the elections were not popular elections for Senate. They were for Congress, but for Senate, the way to become a senator was to make sure that the legislature was going to back you. It was the state legislature, that voted for you. But because Mississippi, like South Carolina, there were certain states that at this time, during this short 12-year period of Reconstruction, free blacks actually outnumbered whites. So they could get their state legislatures to be overwhelmingly black, or if not overwhelmingly black, to be populated by whites who were white Republicans who were liberal enough and willing to elect blacks. So that's how they were able to do that. And because this Mississippi state legislature was so largely black, and because many people like President Grant and even, you know, some of the other Southern top elected officials said, we need to keep some of our black voters happy. They literally felt that they needed to do that, because that's why they actually came to him saying, please be lieutenant governor. They had gone to him to actually ask him to run for lieutenant governor, and he turned them down because they wanted a black lieutenant governor with a white gubernatorial candidate, because their fear was, wait a second, we're outnumbered down here. They have the power to vote. We can't take everything from them. We have to make these gestures. So I don't think they were as aware, though, that he was as politically connected as he was and as shrewd as he was or as wealthy as he was, because he, even after Reconstruction ended, he was not even able to go back to collect the rents on his vast properties in Mississippi. He had to hire whites in Mississippi to front for him to collect these rents. So because he was a very shrewd man, he was very cautious about how much information he gave about himself, how much wealth he had. It was only apparent to people that were very close to him.
At the time he was in the Senate, he was the only black senator.
Yes.
There were some black
members of
Congress over in the House.
Exactly.
How many black men, and of course they were
all men.
How many black men were in Congress as a whole in Congress at the time?
Well, at the time that he was, because unfortunately he obviously entered the Senate during the last 3 years of Reconstruction. Reconstruction ended 1877. He was only elected 1874. So there had been several members of the House prior to him. He was closest to Congressman John Lynch, who was also from Mississippi, and he was actually, along with Frederick Douglass, one of his closest advisors. So the three or four black members of the House who were in office, I mean, there had been several before, but the three or four that were in the House while he was in the Senate lived a very awkward existence, because obviously their terms were only 2 years, and this all ended in 1877, so it was a very short period. He did not enjoy some of the power and influence that the earlier members of the House had enjoyed, who had come in during a time before the deal with President Hayes was cut, before that compromise of 1877, because when that deal was cut and they ended Reconstruction, it not only made it impossible for blacks to be reelected, it removed all the federal troops from the South. It made it literally impossible for blacks to vote without fear of having their homes burned down, without fear of being lynched, fired from their jobs. So it changed everything. But what is miraculous is that this family, that this Bruce family, was able to maintain this dynasty that they just continued to build. And it's because he very shrewdly created a Washington career. His son was obviously very well educated. His son went on to become superintendent of schools from Washington. When Roscoe graduated from Harvard College, Roscoe Bruce's son graduated from Harvard College in 1902, he graduated Phi Beta Kappa. But nobody would hire him. So Josephine Wilson, Bruce, his mom, wrote to Booker T. Washington and said, "Can you at least hire my son? He's graduating Phi Beta Kappa." So that's what enabled this family to get to stay on its feet, is by very shrewdly knowing what powerful people to go to and to call favors from. And he got the job as superintendent of schools after working for Booker T. Washington, which once again elevated the family in D.C. as another generation of a Black Power family.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, he certainly had powerful friends in Washington. He was a friend of Ulysses Grant.
Right.
He went on to serve as head of the state Republican Party in Mississippi. He
right.
had a number of appointments in the Treasury Department. Having said all that, though, was he someone who had particular influence in the Republican Party?
He had influence in the Republican Party when it came to the South, when it came to getting presidential candidates were interested in making sure that the Black vote was going to support them. Absolutely. He had influence for that. Did they respect him for even bringing the white Mississippi vote? No, they didn't. They didn't call on him for advice on appointments. In fact, they called white presidents called more often on Booker T. Washington for advice on appointments, on presidential appointments, than they did for Senator Bruce. And that created a position between the two of them that Senator Bruce envied Booker T. Washington's power and influence.
We talked earlier about the fact that perhaps some other African Americans were maybe a little bit suspicious of the Bruces because of their class standing, because of their wealth, because of the fact that they did have connections with the white power structure. He was, however, a good friend of Frederick Douglass.
Yes, he was a good friend. In fact, was served as best man in Frederick Douglass's second wedding. Frederick Douglass's first wife was Black, but his second wife, most people don't realize this, was white. She was actually a very liberal white woman who had graduated from Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. And Senator, when no one else would do this, Blanche and Josephine Bruce served as best man and matron of honor at Frederick Douglass's wedding, because the Black community was furious that Frederick Douglass, this icon within the Black community that spoke out on behalf of civil rights, was marrying outside of the race. So that was very controversial. So the Bruces served as his witnesses at his wedding, but it was once again not a surprise that this was once again a family that was always stuck between the middle of, because of their wealth, because of their influence, that they were stuck between the Black community and the white community.
We have a caller we'll get to in just a moment here. For the benefit of anyone who's tuned in, I'd like to introduce again the guest. We are talking with Lawrence Otis Graham. He is an attorney, commentator on race, politics, and class in America. He's authored a number of books, including one titled Our Kind of People, Inside America's Black Upper Class. That was a big bestseller. He's done work. It's appeared in a number of places, New York Times, Essence, U.S. News and World Report, Best American Essays. The new book, the one that tells the story of Blanche Bruce, the first African-American to serve a full term in the U.S. Senate. The title of the book is The Senator and the Socialite, and that refers to Senator Bruce and also his wife, who was the daughter of a wealthy family in Philadelphia. Her father was a physician, or was he a dentist, actually?
Well, he was a dentist. He later became a physician, later went to medical school, right.
And the two of them together were cut quite the swath through the Society of Washington at the time, 1880s. And you can read about it in the book. It's published by HarperCollins. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Mr. Graham, I'm really enjoying. You sound so excited about your topic.
Thanks for calling.
If you've talked about this before, I tuned in a little late. The issue of what one calls oneself or society black, white,
right.
Because as I was listening to you, it seems like a person has a grandparent who is black, and then this is revealed, and everyone knows then that he's black. So does this go back to these racial laws, 1/32nd? You know, a drop of blood that makes you black instead of the predominant race that you have?
Very interesting question, a great question. A lot of this does go back to that, because those were the determinations that decided who was going to be a slave and who was going to be free.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, our society holds on to, and certainly they were holding on to this, obviously, when the Bruces, with this at least the first of the three generations of the Bruces I talk about, they obviously were living just beyond the time of slavery, so they obviously were talking about it then. But it also mattered later because of Jim Crow laws, which determined everything from who could ride where on a train.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole Plessy versus Ferguson case, which was 1896, that Supreme Court case, continued that issue, because when you were talking about separate but equal, the government had to decide, okay, who was black and who was white. So they just relied on those outdated laws, when in fact Plessy, the quote-unquote black gentleman, was actually 1/8 black. So as you point out, if someone is the predominant race is white, if he's 7/8 white, why are we holding on to these arbitrary distinctions? And it's purely because of the legal ramifications that they held at that time. And unfortunately today, no one wants to let go of them.
For political reasons on both sides?
Well, I would say as far as the black community is concerned, typically when people have been of mixed race, even if it was 1/8 black, the black community has always been accepting of them. So it's never been the black community that says, okay, well, we don't accept you because you've got, you know, a lot of white in you. It was typically because of restrictive covenants in white communities that said blacks, you know, or anyone with any, you know, one grandparent that's black cannot move into this, you know, into this home, or a title can't travel to that. So the black community has historically been the more accepting of mixed-raced children, because that's where they had to go live.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the sort of the challenges of, let's say, interracial marriage today, I think the only time it becomes controversial in the black community, and I wrote about this in a prior book, Member of the Club, is when it comes to, like, very wealthy, well-known African-American men marrying outside of the race.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the controversy was with O.J. Simpson, but there's been people like Quincy Jones, who's been married 3 times to blonde white women. I think there have been many, particularly black women, who say, you know, why is it that so many of these successful black men, whether it's Clarence Thomas or whoever it is, why are so many of them marrying outside of the race? And I think that's primarily because of the large number of African-American men who have either dropped out of school or who are involved, who are in the prison system. And so the fear is, and especially when you look at both black colleges and predominantly white colleges, the number of black women is generally 3 times the number of black men. So the fear is, well, if every educated black man decides to leave the black community, then there are no black male role models. But obviously the bigger issue that historically that was grappled with was, you know, why do we hold on to these arbitrary distinctions? And but I think it all goes back to it because of the legal reasons that segregation was, in order to maintain it, they had to know who was what.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for calling.
Thanks,
that was a great question.
And others, again, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have probably about 7-8 minutes left in the program. Back at the beginning of the show, we talked about the fact that you're feeling that Blanche Bruce has been unjustly forgotten.
Right.
That one thing that you've been involved in to try to, in some sense, besides writing the book, to reestablish his place in American history, you've been involved with a campaign to try to persuade the post office to put him on a stamp.
Exactly, right. In fact, I started a website. It's senatorbruce.org, senatorbruce.org. And the whole point of that is to allow people to weigh in on this. They can leave their name. They can leave just their email address. It's fine. But one thing that I discovered is that I noticed that out of 159 years of the Postal Service issuing stamps, they've never once put a black elected official on a postage stamp. Now, obviously, there are white presidents on stamps and white governors and white senators, white members of the House. Even white mayors have been put on stamps, and even Jefferson Davis, a Confederate, has a stamp. But then I started to notice that the first woman senator, Hattie Carraway, has a stamp. Dennis Chavez, a Hispanic American senator, has been put on a stamp, but not a single black elected official, not Shirley Chisholm, not any of these great black Reconstruction figures, Adam Clayton Powell, none of them, not a single one. But yet, you know, only 3 weeks ago, the Postal Service, they issue around 50 stamps a year. Just 2 weeks ago, they issued superheroes, so white comic superheroes, Wonder Woman, Batman, Superman, Aquaman on a stamp. And I thought, you know, this is an insult to black people. It's just an insult to all Americans, because it's an American story, the fact that blacks have served in government, and there's no reason why a black elected official should never be put on a stamp. So I wrote to all 100 United States senators, and unfortunately, only two have responded. I told the Postmaster General I will send to him all of the emails of people who are willing to go to senatorbruce.org and just click on it, just to say there are other people that feel this is an important issue. It's not enough for them to put Hattie McDaniel, Mammy, you know, from Gone with the Wind on a postage stamp and say, okay, we've done our thing for commemorating black accomplishment.
Yeah. It certainly does give you the opportunity to think about black accomplishment, particularly when it comes to politics. And you have to point out that, as you do, that at the time that Blanche Bruce was elected to the Senate, there was one black senator. And now it's more than 130 years. There's still only one Barack Obama.
Right.
Only one black senator. And so you sort of have to scratch your head and say, really, is that the best that we can do here now after over 130 years, that there's still only one African-American
exactly. and then refuse to commemorate any of them? So that's why I say that 2006 actually, David, is going to be a very interesting year, because more than ever since Reconstruction, there are more blacks running for top positions for Senate jobs, and not just the Democratic Party, but also Republican Party in several states, as well as gubernatorial elections. So more blacks are running for governor and Senate than ever before. So 2006 is going to be a very interesting election year. So when I set out to write The Senator and the Socialite, the whole plan was obviously to talk about this great first black senator, but was also to talk about, you know, where we've gone with politics with regard to race and class. And I mean, I followed this family right up until because the family has a distinguished record. I mean, not only does the son go to Exeter and Harvard, the grandchildren go to Exeter and Harvard and Harvard Law School and Radcliffe, and constantly accomplishing things. And as I said, they end up working for the Rockefellers and help John D. Rockefeller Jr. open up the very first apartment development aimed at the black middle class and make a tremendous success out of that. He opens up a bank, the first black bank in New York, and they sit on the board there. They give a lot of their money to Howard University, you know, and they've done a lot for charitable causes. So it's a great family. It's an American story, but it's also a political story, which makes us realize the glacier speed by which African Americans have actually, you know, been able to hold top jobs. I mean, it's taken a long time just to get to the same place where we were 132 years ago when it comes to black representation in the Senate.
Yeah, and yet I certainly would not want to understate the success and the achievements of this family. And yet at the same time, it seems that after three generations, you also sort of ask, well, where are they now?
Exactly. It unraveled. It really unraveled because of race and discrimination. But also, I mean, the grandson, Roscoe Jr., who had also gone to Exeter and Harvard like his father, was given a position by John Rockefeller. He was too young. He was 22 years old. His job was to be manager of another apartment complex, different from the one his parents managed. It was owned by Prudential Insurance. He mismanaged some of the money, lost $1,500, and was afraid to tell his parents, was afraid to go back to John D. Rockefeller. So like an idiot, he goes out into the streets and literally hires two thugs to stage a fake holdup and says, I'll pay you $300 if you take, and I'm going to tell the police you took $1,800. That covers the $1,500 he lost, which his parents easily could have replenished. But he was embarrassed to tell them. So he stages the holdup. The police don't buy the story. He breaks down. And then the judge, to punish him, sends him to prison for 2 years. The family practically goes bankrupt to keep him out of jail. And then Rockefeller is so embarrassed by this, he fires the parents from the bank, fires them from the apartment complex. Then by 1950, they're on public assistance in New York. I mean, so literally from their incredible wealth, the wealthiest blacks in Washington owning plantations and apartment buildings and everything, to literally completely destitute. And, I mean, the family has remade some of that wealth today, but unfortunately there are those who live as black who are accomplished, but then many more, unfortunately, who pass as white or as another ethnic group, different ethnic groups that they claim to be. Mm. And so it's a story that has a bit of tragedy in it. Mm.
Are there other figures like Blanche Bruce whose stories have also forgotten and who
well,
needed to be
told? People like James Warmley. There's the Warmley family, and the Syphax family, as I mentioned earlier. I think they're a fascinating family that owned the acreage that Arlington Cemetery was built upon. And that very little has been talked about. And once again, because there are family members today who pass and who don't want to acknowledge ties to them. But the Warmley family owned one of the most famous hotels called Warmley House in Washington. And ironically, it was where the Compromise of 1877 was signed, where President Hayes was officially named president. It was signed in this black family's hotel, which was on 15th Street in the Northwest quadrant of D.C., which was the premier hotel to stay in during the 1800s. It was owned by a black family and that remained wealthy for several generations. So there are many stories like this, but unfortunately not enough family members and descendants willing to tell the stories.
Well, for people who want to read more of this story, the story of Senator Blanche Bruce, his wife, his children, it is told in the book The Senator and the Socialite, The True Story of America's First Black Dynasty. HarperCollins is the publisher on the book and the author. Our guest this morning, Lawrence Otis Graham. Mr. Graham, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.